relief factor, pain relief that's natural, pain relief that works, and pain relief that attacks the source of the pain. That's the experience of tens of thousands of Americans who are taking Relief Factor right now. See their incredible video endorsements at ReliefFactor.com and then order your three-week quick starter pack for just $19.95. That's less than a dollar a day. Find out if it can work for you like it works for me by ordering your three-week quick starter pack today. ReliefFactor.com, ReliefFactor.com. Be the next success story.
Would you tell us where you were when you heard about the first attack in 93 against the World Trade Center?
Well, back in 93.
Yes.
In 93, I was in private law practice. I was a lawyer, and I was running for mayor. It was the year of the election for mayor of New York. I had run in 1989 against David Dinkins and lost by less than 2%. So as far as I was concerned, things didn't go well in the city in that three-year period. We had two riots. We had 2,000 murders a year. We were at 10% unemployment. I mean, a lot of really, really bad factors. I felt I should run because the solutions that I had suggested in 89 were not put into place, and I thought the same ones I suggested in 89 would work in 93. Particularly crime. And my background was criminal justice. I was an assistant U.S. attorney. I was head of the narcotics division in the U.S. attorney's office during the French Connection days. I was the U.S. attorney who went after the mafia and put away the five families in New York. I prosecuted Boesky and Milken and Wall Street. I prosecuted about half of Ed Koch's administration. So I knew corruption in the city. In a strange way, I felt like, maybe it's a little boastful to say, I felt like I was the right person. If the city ever needed a prosecutor, this is the time it needed one. And not just a prosecutor, but a very experienced one. I was the third, and then I was the third ranking official in Ronald Reagan's Justice Department. I worked for President Reagan for 8 years, and he was my hero. He was, I was going to model what I did as mayor on what he did as president. I handled the air traffic controller strike with Ted Olson. We were the two lawyers on the air traffic controller strike. So I wasn't just part of the administration. I really bought into it. I bought into the tax programs. I was the first mayor in the history of the city to lower taxes. I mean, nobody in New York ever thought about lowering taxes before. So so I decided by 1992 that I had to run, that the city needed lower taxes, a better business environment, and my goodness, it needed to cut the 2,000 murders a year. Otherwise, we weren't going to be around very long.
By the time you were mayor, you shared something very interesting about the threat assessment as the targets for terrorist attack in New York. When it comes to Washington, it was clear, the Pentagon, military power, you're thinking of Congress for Flight 93. But the World Trade Center wasn't the top-ranked target, was it, Mr. Mayor?
No, it was actually the stock exchange. And if you think about it, the World Trade Center was not the center of trade. I think they thought it was. We don't really do a lot of trading in the World Trade Center. If you wanted to hit the center of trade, you would hit the New York Stock Exchange. It's an office building, and a big office building, and an important office building with very critical functions, but it's not much different than another office building in New York, where it was a, from their point of view, a good target, is it was a transportation hub. So it really, really, for a long period of time, made a major dent in transportation. Also, any place down there would be a tough place to hit. But because of what was across the street, which I don't even think they knew, the major electric lines to all of lower Manhattan, because AT&T was there. And the AT&T building was collaterally hit with a big hole in the center of it. So it put out electricity in all of lower Manhattan. And finally, the part of the city that they hit, now they may have known this, is literally underwater. So there was a danger there that never happened, thank God, that whole area could have been flooded. because the slurry walls that keep out the Hudson River were damaged. So let's say we had had even a mild hurricane, we could have flooded out all of Lower Manhattan. So the first thing we did was furiously put those slurry walls back together and just pray for no rain.
Where were you at the time of the first impact, and when did you realize that this wasn't an accident, a lost plane that had accidentally hit the tower?
I was at the Peninsula Hotel on 55th Street, right off Fifth Avenue, having breakfast with Dennison Young and Bill Simon. Dennison Young was my chief assistant and my partner 35, 38 years until the day he died earlier this year. And Bill Simon was a former assistant U.S. attorney, the son of Secretary of the Treasury Simon, and who worked for me and was thinking of running for governor of California. And I thought this was a wonderful day to just talk about politics, which I like to do for relaxation, because it was primary day. They were voting for the Republican and Democratic nominees for mayor of New York and all of the other citywide positions. So I didn't think it would be that busy a day in the early morning. So I thought it would be a good time to have a breakfast rather than my 8 o'clock meeting, which I had scheduled for 4 o'clock. So it was a nice time to have breakfast. We had a terrific talk about his chances of winning the Republican primary against Dick Reardon, who was the mayor of Los Angeles. It was a race almost like you'd have now, although not with the where Dick was the more, let's say, moderate Republican, and Bill was a pretty much mainstream conservative Republican. So the discussion was about could he win the primary in a place like California? What would happen in the general election? And all of a sudden, Patty Verone, who was one of the four police officers with me that day, who was a permanent part of my detail, walks in, says something to Denny Young. He sort of motions to her to tell me. She comes over and she says, "Mayor, there's a terrible, terrible fire at the World Trade Center. It's really, seems like it's getting out of control. And I think you're going to want to go down there." I said, yeah, we do. What do you know about it? "It looks like a twin-engine plane hit the North Tower," she said. And I said, "Oh, my God, okay." So I told Bill, and we immediately got up, walked out of the restaurant. And very ominously, Bill, who normally would shake my hand or maybe give me a little hug, he just kind of put his arms around me and said, "I'll pray for you." From what he heard, it couldn't have sounded much worse than a fire. But maybe the way she said it, I don't know. But it was a very, very, it was a very emotional hug. And as we were getting into the car, I told him to please get the police commissioner and the White House on the phone. So I wanted to find out, is this attack connected to anything else? And when we turned the block onto Fifth, and I could see the top of the World Trade Center, and what I saw and what Denny saw was a lot more fire than you would expect from a twin-engine plane. And I think the first two things we said was, it's not an accident, the sky was too blue, and this is not a twin-engine plane. And immediately, I'd say, if you asked me then, I was 80% sure it was a terrorist attack. And if it was a terrorist attack, I knew it was bin Laden because he had threatened us before. I was briefed every week on terrorist attacks because we had terrorist trials going on in New York. We had the whole area around the courthouse cordoned off. We had the whole area around City Hall cordoned off because of their threats. We had almost canceled the 2000 New Year's celebration because of their threats. And Louis Free, who was the head of the FBI at the time, was one of my assistant U.S. attorneys and a very close friend. So I probably got a few more briefings than you normally would get. I knew the city was under threat from bin Laden, no doubt about that. And we had done exercises and plans for how to deal with it. And even the differences between his people and the people we normally dealt with, which were the Islamic extremists in New Jersey, who had brought about the first World Trade Center attack.
And then when the second impact occurred, where were you and what did
when
you
the
do?
When the second impact occurred, I was less than a mile away, less than a minute away. I had just been on the phone with my deputy mayor, Joe Loder, who told me how bad it was, and I told him and with the police commissioner, and I told him when I got there, I wanted us to have secured a building where we had hard lines, telephone lines, because the cell phones were erratic.
Yeah.
Some were working, some weren't working. I said, Bernie, we got to get hard lines. Just grab a building and let's set up right there. And with Joe, I said, we've got to get Rudy Washington and make sure Rudy's there, because we got to get the transportation lanes open right away. Because I realized there was going to be an incredible amount of equipment going in and out of there, and that could block the ambulances. And Rudy was an expert on transportation. And there were a lot of other conversations, but I can't remember. And I said, has anybody been able to get through to the White House? And the answer was no. I said, well, I've tried three times and I haven't gotten through. Do we have air cover? I mean, we've already been hit by two planes. It could have been three. Could have been four, could have been eight. And they said, no, we haven't been able to. Just at about that time, I hung up the phone, I heard a tremendous explosion. We look up, there's this tremendous explosion in the sky. Jenny and I and the police were not sure whether it was a secondary explosion from the first one or a new something. It looked more like a new something. And almost as we're thinking that, Bernie Kerik called and said, boss, it's a second plane. This is a terrorist attack. This is Bin Laden. I said, okay, well, we're already doing it. Let's just keep executing our plan. And let's start bringing them all in, because we're going to have to cover all our priority targets. So the first thing I want to do when I get there, Bernie, is I want to go see Gansey. I'm going to give him whatever part of the police department he wants.
And Gansey is?
Gansey was the chief of the, he was the chief uniform firefighter. The commissioners in New York City, which is interesting, which goes back to Teddy Roosevelt. The commissioners in New York City are like the defense secretary. They're civilians. Even though they may have been police officers, they're civilians. Same thing with the fire department. So like Tom Von Essen was a firefighter. But when he became a commissioner, he had to wear a suit. But then each department has a chief of patrol or a chief of command. Gansey was the chief firefighter. And superb at what he did. I can't say enough about him. And I had numerous fires and had worked with him for 8 years and had 100% confidence in him. And he could have told me I need 8,000 police, I'd give them to him. I don't know where I'd gotten the other ones I needed. I probably would have called Nassau County or something. But I would have given him whatever he needed. So I get there, and Joe Loder immediately tells me people are jumping out of the buildings. My reaction is, that can't be true. Maybe Joe is overreacting or something.
And who's Joe?
Joe was my chief deputy mayor. Number two to the mayor. So God forbid I died, he'd become the mayor. Or if I were out of the country, he was the acting mayor. I looked up, all I saw was debris, and I didn't ask Bernie. And then I said, let's go see Gansey. We start walking down there, and we turn the corner, so we're facing it directly, and it was like, I've never seen anything like it. It was like living in hell. It was like looking at something out of Dante's Inferno, kind of reversed, where the fire would be below rather than above. And I could start making out people on the roof. Then I don't know the sequence in which this happened. I think the first thing I did was I saw Father Michael Judge, who was the chief, really the chief chaplain for the fire department. And my very, very close friend, and maybe I should say spiritual guidance counselor or spiritual person I went to for support and advice, the person who taught me how to tell people about death. When my first firefighters died, three of them died. It turned out to be three, but it was one. Then the next day, one. And then finally, one. 3 months later, I said to him, I don't know how to, you know, I'm a lawyer and a prosecutor. I know how to put people in prison, but I don't know how to explain death. He said, well, you come with me. And when you go to their house, the fact that the mayor has come into their house will be a great honor for them. It'll make them feel like their son was a very important person, because he was. There's nothing you can do for them except make them feel that he was a hero, because he was a hero. And make them feel that the city appreciates the terrible sacrifice he had to make. And also make them feel that they're going to have support. That they're not alone, they're going to have support, including financial support. Because at least that takes care of one area. So that was my first of 40... with firefighters, 46 or 47, and with police officers, about the same number. And okay, so firefighters, Father Judge was always with me. So I saw Father Judge, and I went over to him.
Where are you now physically?
So now I'm walking on the west side, what would be the West Side Drive, the westernmost avenue. So I'm walking along the West Side Drive. The World Trade Center is over here, and I'm about a block away. And Pete Gansey is over here with his command post set up so that he has a view as best he can of both buildings, because they overlapped each other. So you couldn't see all of the second building. It was covered by some of the first. But from where he was, you could see the largest amount of it selected, I'm sure, for that purpose. So I'm walking to, I can now see him, but I'm not in really talking distance of him or even yelling distance. See Father Judge, and I ask him, Father, pray for us, which I always would ask him. And we had a joke in which he would say, oh, would it be better if you prayed? It would be more unusual and God would pay attention to it. And I said, okay, Father, thanks. You're off the hook. He wasn't funny. I said, Father, pray for us. He said, I am. And then he grabbed me and he says, you know you have it in you for this. I said, what do you mean? He said, this is much worse. This is much worse than anything we faced. You got it in you. Don't worry. I think he knew he was going to die. I just had a feeling he knew what was going to happen about a half hour later to him and about a half hour later to me. And almost immediately upon waving, I looked up because the police were saying, look up, because debris was falling. I could see people being hit with things. And all of a sudden, I just got fixated on a man up about 100 stories. And I could see a body sort of dangling out of a window. And all of a sudden, the man fell. And I just stopped. Probably shouldn't have stopped, but I was transfixed, and I watched it come all the way down. And he hit the ground. And I never saw anything like that before in my life. And almost impossible to calculate what that was all about. And I grabbed Bernie's arm and Denny, and I said, I probably repeated a little bit of what Father Judge said. I said, you know, this is much worse than anything we've ever faced before. We're going to have to just make it up as we go along. And just stay calm. Pretend we're calm. Stay calm. And just make the right decision, common sense, and ask God to help us. And God will make the decisions right. We're not going to, this is beyond us. And they agreed with me. And the next thing I remember, we got to Pete. And first question I said to him is, can we get we get helicopters up there. Because the man had jumped, and at this point now I had seen other people jumping, and I had seen people hanging out the windows, and I had seen people at the top of the building. And I thought, simplistically, maybe we could get helicopters up there. And Pete answered it in a very firefighter kind of way. He said, Boss, my guys can save everybody below the fire. It was an interesting way of saying, you're naturally stupid. Look at those fires. The helicopter's going to blow up. And how are they going to walk through that? And when he said it, it had a different effect, though, on me. The effect it had on me was, everybody I'm looking at above that fire is dead.
Yeah.
He just told me everybody above that fire is dead. And it was a real feeling of impotence. And I just thought we had it. Wasn't there something we could do? Or, I don't know, get some magic helicopter or get them off the damn roof. Or now, some of those people did get saved because there was a back stairway, but most of them died. Then I grabbed Bernie and Joe Dunn, who were the two ranking police people. Pete had his people, and I put them together and said, now you guys figure out how we're going to give them the police help they need. I said, it's clear to all of us now, right? Pete is the incident commander.
So this is a very important point, that when you have a catastrophe of this magnitude, one of the biggest mistakes that can be made is that you don't have clear delineation of who's
very
in charge.
Very true, Sebastian, absolutely.
So how did you make sure that everybody knew that this was now a fire department responsibility?
Yeah. This is something that, this is something where we benefited from prior history. I mean, we had had incidents in New York where there was great confusion over who's in charge, who isn't in charge. It's happened in all cities, all places. And I had started the day that I became mayor. I instituted a new office called the Mayor's Office of Emergency Management. I did it because of the 93 attack. And their job really was to study emergencies and to lay out plans for us. And they were almost, in some ways, they were emergency planners and they were negotiators. They would go back and forth between the departments and get them to agree on who would be in charge of this, who would be in charge of that, so that that fight didn't take place at the incident. It was already decided. And one of the reasons that I went to every incident was to make sure it was decided. Because once they said it to me, the fighting stopped. You know, once they said, police department, fire department was fine with it. Once they said, fire department, police department was fine with it. Until then, who knows what could happen. So basically, this one was a very terrible situation, but a fairly simple decision. Had it been a terrorist attack, and the terrorist was still in the building, terrorizing people, about to kill people, possibly going to kill people, the police department and the FBI would have been in charge. It would have been a law enforcement mission, and the fire department would have been secondary to do what they could about the fire without interfering with the trying to saving of lives from the terrorists. But here it was clear that the two planes were filled with terrorists and they were dead with everybody else in the building, so we weren't searching for terrorists anymore. Not in that building. So that this is a fire department mission. They are completely in charge. So I asked Pete to decide, how many cops do you need? How many cops do you need to clear the streets? How many cops do you need to make sure the ambulances come in?
But you made that clear. You went to the command center and you said,
yeah, you decide,
this,
what do you need?
FDNY's in charge.
Said directly to the commissioner, give him what he needs. You know, like, and none of them would have done it. Well, I got to tell you, everybody I dealt with that day was overwhelmed by the magnitude of it, and there was no pettiness at all. Whatever pettiness you had was like just ripped out of you by the enormity of what you were dealing with. And Bernie basically said, you got what you want, you know. And he asked for a certain number of police. He told Bernie what he wanted them to do. First thing he wanted, main thing he wanted was to get the people the hell out of there. He said, you get these people out of here. This is crazy. They're coming out of the building, and they're blocking the streets. They're watching the fire. Half of them are running, as they should. And the other half don't realize the danger. They don't realize that they're watching people get hit. with debris, and they're standing there half a block away. But there is something, and I think any firefighter will tell you this, there's something magnetic, transfixing about a fire. You just watch it. He said, you tell them to go north. And he said, the minute you get a microphone there, you just tell them to get the hell out of here. If you got to scare them, scare them. You got to bring the horses down, bring the horses down. He'll get burned. You have to bring the horses down, bring the horses down. And then I think somebody said they're afraid of fire. Then they continued with a little more in-depth conversation, not exactly sure what, but about exactly the other kind of help he would need with the medical emergencies. And I turned around to some of the other firefighters that were there and asked them about how many people were in the building, which they didn't know the number of people in the building. They gave me the number of firefighters they thought were in the building. And then I saw Chief Downey. And Chief Downey was maybe third of a block away in an alcove. And he had around him about 20 people. And he had a board, which he used to use. Now, Chief Downey was in charge of our search and rescue team. And he was very well known nationally. Because he's one of the people that trained many of the national search and rescue teams. He was one of the people sent to Oklahoma City. He had gotten Governor Keating of Oklahoma, had given all of them medals, had given 80 of our search and rescue team members medals because of all the time they spent there. And I had just given him a going away party. Because he wouldn't retire. And Tom Von Essen and I thought it might be good to give him a going away party. Not that we wanted to get rid of him, but that his wife used to complain all the time that he was too old for this. And he had four sons, or three sons in the department. They could do his work. I'm not sure he had actually retired, but he had had a retirement party. And I didn't get a chance to, I wanted to go over and talk to him. But he was just a little too far away, and I had to get to the police department command post because I wanted to get on the phone with the White House. I really wanted to find out. I wanted to get my mind off the rescue effort as soon as possible so I could get it on to I knew I wasn't going to be able to run the rescue effort, but what I could do was try to keep the rest of the city safe. So I looked at Downey, and I waved to him, went like this, and waved to a couple of other people because I knew them probably really better than most firefighters because I was involved with a lot of their fires a lot. And of course, I was involved a lot in Oklahoma City. Bernie had finished, Bernie and Joe Dunn had finished with Pete and they hugged each other. And then Pete hugged me and I said, yup, I'll be praying for you. And he said, I know, we're going to need a lot of prayers. He said, this is going to be a long one. In fact, I've got to talk to Tom about figuring out how we start now relieving the people that have been here. Because this is going to be really long. We're going to be here days, he said. So that said to me, in retrospect, when we think about how the buildings came down, he didn't think there's going to be an implosion. He thought there was going to be, I think he thought the buildings were going to come down. But I think he thought the buildings were going to come down the way we're more used to buildings coming down. In sections. Top part, middle part, bottom part, and then maybe you got to get rid of the rest of the building. I had no sense from anyone that they thought there would be some kind of immediate collapse of the building. We left him, and we walked back a block and a half, two blocks, to the newly installed police communication center. They had taken a Merrill Lynch street office, chased everybody out. I'm sure they were very happy to leave, and installed their own phone lines directly to the White House, Pentagon, wherever we install them to when we're in an emergency. So we had hard lunch. I walked in, and they had the White House on the phone already. I talked to Chris Hennick at the White House. And I said, Chris, this is terrible. I probably started with, has the Pentagon been hit? Because I had gotten all these rumors. Pentagon hit, Mall of America hit, Sears Tower hit. I said, tell me what's right. Has the Pentagon been hit? He said, affirmative. I said, what about the Mall of America? He said, no, just the Pentagon. But there are 7 planes unaccounted for. I said, are any of them headed to New York? He said, we can't tell, but it could be. But we have scrambled. But we have them, I don't know exactly what he said, in our sights, or we have them under surveillance, or we have control. In other words, they're not going to hit you, because we're going to take them down before they do. That's the feeling that I got. In other words, we got them under control. But then he said, but we don't. He gave me this. He said something else that said, but there could be more. We got 7 that we have on a board, but we don't know about others. I said, do we have air cover? He said, oh, yes. The vice president sent the jets out. Oh, gosh, he said, it seems to me 15, 20 minutes ago. They should be there by now. Nothing else. He said, I don't think anything else will hit your city. I found out later that Cheney had made the decision to take those planes down if he had to. Would have been a heck of a thing, huh? Yeah, I always wondered about that in retrospect. Imagine if he took a plane down, he took the wrong one down. Well, in any event, what that did, and I said, what about the possibility of other attacks? He said, big possibility. Something like, that's something you got to start thinking about. And he said, the vice president will call you back within a very few minutes. I said, why not the president? He said, the president's being evacuated. Now, I did not know he was in Florida. So I had a conception in my mind, which was somewhat frightening, that they were rushing him out of the White House. I mean, you think of one of those movies where they do that, and that they got the president, they're rushing him out of the White House, they're putting him on Air Force One. I knew the protocol that they would fly him around until the country was safe. I knew that's what he was talking about. I didn't know it was commencing in Florida, but having worked in the White House, and during the Cold War when we used to actually do these drills, I knew what that meant. That was a very frightening thought. It was, they could put the president up in the air, because they're afraid they can't protect him on the ground. I always thought all the criticism of Bush about not being available is so ignorant and so stupid. The last thing in the world we needed at that time was the president to get killed. And maybe it looks a little, or like when they put Trump downstairs when they were going to possibly invade the White House. No president wants that. Presidents don't want to be made to look like, but that's a responsible thing to do. I mean, if in the middle of that they put a bomb on the head of the president, the country would be lost. So I accepted that as perfectly reasonable thing to do. But also as to how serious this is. If they're putting the president up in the air, they don't have a really good feeling for where we're going to get hit next, which means every one of my priority targets is a priority target. And what do I have to defend them? I get to pick up the bodies once they're hit. I don't have airplanes. So Bernie, I told Bernie, I told Bernie and everybody around me what had just been said. I can't remember exactly how much time went by. I'm going to say just maybe 2-3 minutes. And I was told the vice president was on a phone 2 offices away. So I walked, and these are all glass offices. So I walked over to the third office, pick up a phone, and it's the White House switchboard. And it says, Mayor Giuliani, Vice President Cheney will be with you in a moment. Just at about that time, the phone goes out, the desk starts to shake, the building starts to shake. I look outside and I see we had about 40 people with us, and they had been taking deaths. They were like just assuming their roles, communication roles, and they were all going under the desk. They were under the desk.
How physically far away are you from the Twin Towers?
So it's like it's like an office with a lot of exterior desks that are just wide open.
But the office is how far from the World Trade Center?
Yes, it's about two blocks.
Two blocks.
And it's an office where you enter almost like a bank office without the tellers. A whole bunch of desks where you can freely talk to people. And then in the along the corners, there were glassed in offices for the executives, I guess. So the people running the communication equipment were in the outer office, setting it all up on the phone. And in those other offices were some of the chiefs making other calls. So I went to one office, and then I was taken to another one where Cheney called. And while I'm waiting for Cheney to get on the phone, the desk starts to shake. The building starts to shake. I look out, and I see people go under, and John Humain grabs me and says, "Let's go under the table." And he grabs me, gets me about halfway down, and said, "No, I don't want to go under the table. But what good is it going to do? Let's stay up here and let's see if we can get through to Cheney." Well, the building settled. Went outside. Everybody got out. Bernie and I discussed it, and I said, "You know, this building on Barclay Street is connected to the building on Church Street. We had offices in that building on Church Street. It was our law office. It's where our corporation counsel. New York City has a law office of 1,000 lawyers, so it's a law office." And I said, I bet, which is a heck of a thing to bet at a time like that, but I bet they're connected underground. And one of the firefighters with us said, "Yes, they are. In fact, there are a number of connections. There are a number of connections, not just to that building, but to the building one block north of Barclay Street, underground." So, not having any idea how bad it was, I could see outside at this point debris flowing through the street. But it wasn't too bad. It still looked like it didn't make sense to go out the front door or you'd get smashed in the head. So I thought, "Well, let's go downstairs and we'll be, here's, it's coming from this way, right? This is Barclay Street where we are. So by going downstairs, we could go to this street right over here, which is Church Street, and we'd be blocked by four or five buildings," which seemed to me to be fine. That'd be great. It didn't seem any much worse than that. So we go downstairs, and we try to find a door that's open, and we can't find one. And I'll tell you a funny story, because there's always humor in the middle of these things, black humor, I guess, but humor. Joe Dunn was the number two commissioner of the police department, which is a very, very high position. And he was one of our most experienced and one of our very, very best police officers. He had solved crime in Brooklyn. It was our first big victory over crime. He had just fractured his ankle playing basketball with his son. And he had been at one or two meetings with me with his crutches, and we talked a little about it. And he was there walking around following it, the commissioner, his boss, around on crutches. So we go downstairs, and everybody getting a little nervous now that we're trapped in a building. We get, and we're about to open the first door, and I say to Bernie, "Hey, we better wait for Joe. Hey, the crutches and all." I look behind me, and Joe's right behind me. I said, "Joe, what happened to the crutches?" He said, "I threw the goddamn things away." he got cured. It's just like one of those cures, right? He was running like crazy. But the door wouldn't open. Went to another door, wouldn't open. Another door, wouldn't open. We went back upstairs to see if we could go out upstairs. Now out upstairs was hell. You couldn't see anything. It was all black. The only thing you could see is occasional things like flying through the street. You didn't know what, like furniture or something like that. You couldn't go outside. There was no way out downstairs. So we're just going to have to try downstairs again and maybe smash one of those doors open. And then two janitors show up They come up from, we heard you downstairs. Most of those doors have been locked for a long time, but there are two possibilities. Let's go down and see if we can get through the two, but it'll take you right into the lobby. You'll be right outside again, but on Church Street. So, hey, that's better than this. So we take a long walk downstairs. We basically walk an entire block underground. And the door opens. Here's a great sigh of relief. All the people behind me, 40 people behind me, sigh of relief. Bernie and I and Denny Young are the first to walk through. We get into the lobby of Church Street, which is a glass lobby, wide open, and it looks like you went from bad to worse. You look outside and it looked like, I know this is maybe a silly comparison, but it looked like the scene in Alice in, not Alice in Wonderland, the movie.
Wizard of Oz?
The Wizard of Oz. It looked like the hurricane and the Wizard of Oz with the things flying through the street, and all of a sudden, one of our most experienced police officers, a guy who was a black belt and tough as nails, comes in. His whole face is beaten up. He looks frightened as hell. And he says, it's awful out there. I said, May, you better not come out there. It's awful out there. They got people lying on the ground. They're getting hit. They're getting smashed. He said, this thing isn't stopping. This flow of, I guess the building was still coming down in certain ways and driving this through the canyons were also probably helping to make it more forceful. And so we had to make a decision. Do we stay in the building or do we go out? And the building now is shaking. And Bernie and Denny and I don't remember who contributed what to the conversation, but the joint conversation was, if we stay in the building, what's the big risk of each? Big risk of staying in the building is we all could die. I lose 50, the city loses four of its top five deputy mayors. It loses not only the chief of the police department, because the chief of the police department was with us, but also the commissioner and the deputy commissioner, who all of whom were, I mean, that's like about 90 years of police experience. And they were all, super good. I mean, they were really great. We had about four or five of Tommy's top people with us. And we already knew we had lost some of our top people. We knew for sure we were going to lose some. With the building coming down, my God, I didn't know how much of my fire department I had lost, but now I would lose more of it. Plus, my deputy mayor for operations, who was an expert on all the buildings in the city, my deputy mayor for transportation, who was going to be critical to being able to get people to move around the city, because if you have to do magic. And I decided very quickly, we're going to go outside. Because if we go outside, and this is, I don't know how I made this decision without any emotion, but afterwards when I thought back on it, I said, wow. The decision I made was, some of us will get killed if we go outside, but not all of us. So a big chunk will survive. And we actually discussed it, and we've discussed it afterwards many, many times, and none of us had any emotion about it. It was a discussion should I move my glasses from here, and would they be safer here? Well, they wouldn't be safe either place, but they'd be a little safer here. So we went outside. I took the press with me. That's where I held my first press conference. They weren't sure they wanted to come. And I told them the same thing. I said, hey, you're in a building, you could crash. Out there, we got a shot. They said, well, if you let us stay close to you, we all of a sudden became friends. And that's where I held my first press conference, where I said, the police department and the fire department are organizing this. It's under their control. We've got the two very best police departments and fire departments in the whole world. We're going to have to trust them and rely on them. Nothing you can do but listen to what they say and what the fire chief would like you now to do is to, if you're in that area, go north and get out of the area. But go north. Reason he was saying that now that I recall is to the extent things were falling and the wind was shifted the other way. So if you went north, you were pretty safe. You weren't going to get hit. Now, that wasn't true once the buildings came down. But he didn't know the buildings were going to come down. Once the buildings came down, in fact, it did go north. So now we had to decide, where are we going to regroup? The Emergency Management Center was in the part of the city where the lights went out. Couldn't use that. Okay, we'll go to the police department, which has an Emergency Management Center backup. Bernie makes a quick call, electricity out in that part of the city. A couple of suggestions of going to the first precinct, which is a very large precinct, more than a usual precinct. It's the one that's always used for the famous arraignments and arrests. People would recognize it. It's where Epstein was arrested, and just anytime they do a famous arrest, it's the first precinct. I don't know why, but maybe because it's big and they have cells there. Thought it was too small. There's a firehouse right at the beginning of the village that I knew really well because it's the firehouse that lost the 3 firefighters when I was first mayor. And it's a big one. I always liked it. And I had dinner there a few times. And I thought that could be a quick emergency management center for us. And I said, actually, let's head there because we could walk there and let's regroup there because we can make calls from there. And as we were doing that, all of a sudden, I feel John Huvane, who was an Irish football player and a big one, grab me and start running me. So all of a sudden, I'm involuntarily running. So about 20 steps of that, I say, John, what am I running for? He said, don't you hear it? I turn around, and I don't know what I see in back. It looked like an atomic explosion. That was the second building coming down. And it was already beginning. The cloud was already beginning to come through the street. So it must have been about 10 blocks, 8 blocks away. But you could see it coming through the street, coming to get you. So I said, stop. Let's stop running and let's see what we're going to do. And there was this poor guy who was an older man. He was limping and he was having a hard time. And I said, Bernie, we were walking and there were police cars following us, like Bernie's car and this car. I said, let's use those cars for these people. So we put civilians in the cars to get them out of there. And we decided maybe we would use it. There was a hotel there, and we thought we were going to use the hotel. Someone mentioned it, so we walk into the hotel. We're going to take it over. This is where we're going to put the police and the fire department. And Tom, I think Tom Von Essen was with us now. Had joined us, but certainly Bernie and Richie Shearer and myself. And we walk into the lobby, and we tell the manager we might want to use it. And before we even finish the sentence, we all look at each other, and we walk right through the lobby and walk out. It was an old glass building. But we hadn't seen it because it was an old glass building until we got inside, and we said, yeah, that'd be really smart, put ourselves in an old glass building. So we get out, and we get up to the firehouse. And the firehouse, of course, was closed. All those people were down there, and they lost most of them. And John Huvane took a fire extinguisher that was outside and smashed the door open. So we got in, and that's the first time I was able to make a call. And the first person I called, before I called the president, was Governor Pataki. And I wanted the National Guard, which was very unusual. I spent 7.5 years always turning down the National Guard. I got the governor on the phone, and he said, thank God, Rudy. We thought you were missing. he actually thought I was dead, which he had told me later. Not at the time. They had actually prepared papers for somebody being appointed to take over the city and to make decisions. And had I not shown up in about 15 more minutes, they're about to execute that they needed decisions made. Now, that doesn't mean I wouldn't have taken over right away, but they had a report that we went into a building and that the building came down. I believe people mistakenly thought we went into a different building right near our building that did go down. And I think that's the case, but that's the best that I can reconstruct.
Let me just ask one question right now at this point.
Right.
Given the level of detail that you've just shared, this first-person eyewitness that is incomparable or just so rare to hear exposed like this, we're more than 20 years later, and there are still insane conspiracy theories that it didn't happen, it wasn't a plane, the U.S. government did it. Could you just talk to people who are in this country today who believe that about 9/11, Mr. Mayor?
Yeah, first of all, it's hard for me because I lived through it. So I know it was a plane. I know it was a plane. I know how it happened. There were people who say, well, they couldn't have melted the steel. Well, it had thousands and thousands of pounds of jet fuel burning, and it burns at like 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 degrees of Fahrenheit. And we burn steel.
That's how we make it.
Yeah, I mean, steel burns. It isn't as if steel does. I've heard people say, well, steel doesn't burn easily. Of course it burns. If you have the right temperature, you burn it. Well, think about it. You had this airliner in the middle of the building, or maybe a little more than the middle of the building, sitting there, leaking massive amounts of gasoline into the building, and then the fire is getting greater and greater and greater. 1,000 degrees Fahrenheit, 2,000 degrees, 3,000 degrees, 4,000 degrees. It was explained to me that very day by Charlie Hirsch, the medical examiner, when he was explaining to me that I wasn't going to recover any bodies. I said to him, Charlie, how many body bags do I need? He said, you're not going to need many, because you're not recovering bodies. You're recovering pieces that we're going to do by DNA, because the bodies were pulverized and they evaporated. He said, if it burned the steel, what do you think it did to the human body? And I thought, okay, Charlie, I got it. So, I can retrospect, all these things are easier to think about. Sometime, I don't know how it or what it would have changed, but I wonder why I didn't think of, or Bernie or Pete or whatever, didn't think of the fact that all this gasoline was pouring into the building and that it would melt it. Now, I'm not sure I would have known that it would have melted it until now, until this point. But now that you tell it to me, it makes all the sense in the world.
And to those who believe it today?
I had one woman ask me something like that at the University of Oklahoma. I was at Oklahoma State. I was giving a lecture about this. And this one woman, a very nice woman, asked me this question about, why did we give all the steel? Why did we give all the steel away so nobody could really examine what happened to it? Like, why did I let the FBI give all the steel away? I said, well, first of all, we didn't give any steel away. We gave, what she's talking about is we gave away little pieces of steel that people could use for memorials after the entire investigation was done. And, it would represent 1% of 1% of 1% of the steel. But her thesis was that we gave it away because if you looked at the steel, you'd have been able to tell that Bush was really responsible for it. And I actually got so frustrated. I did it nicely, though, as a joke. I thought I was going to get thrown out of the college. I said to her, ma'am, you've asked me now 4 times, and I told you. I said, first of all, while I was the mayor, which was 4 months, I don't think I gave any steel away. Maybe I gave a few pieces, like to a city or to a mayor or to a fire department that wanted to have it for their memorial, but it would have been like a little teeny piece about this building. All the steel went to Staten Island. The FBI has it. And by the way, the mayor doesn't get to give away
evidence.
The steel. She said, well, maybe your predecessor, maybe your successor, Bloomberg, gave it away. I said, well, I don't think he had the authority to give it away. But in any event, that isn't the way it happened. She said, well, you're just wrong. I said, okay, would you accept in good faith a really helpful suggestion? She said, well, it depends on what it is. I said, Oklahoma State is a great university. They have a great psychology department, and I'm sure they have some great psychiatrists. Would you please go see one? I mean, just get some help, because this is what you're saying is beyond irrational. And we don't need that. We got enough problems. There are enough issues with this as to how it happened, why it happened, and we don't need irrational ones. But I don't know why, but doesn't that happen all the time?
It does.
It happens with the Kennedy assassination, but there at least you have some issues like, one shooter, two shooters. Could it have actually happened that way? And I can see how people would have different opinions about this. But you can see the picture of the plane going into the building. I mean, what did somebody make up the picture?
Beyond the crazy conspiracies, we're more than 20 years later now. Do you think most Americans outside of New York properly appreciate what happened here on that day adequately, Mr. Mayor?
Ooh, that's a very good question, Sebastian. Well, probably not. I mean, it's like saying can I properly appreciate what somebody went through in the Second World War if I wasn't in it? Or can I empathize with it? Sure. Can I get pretty close to realizing the terrible horror and terrible... Yeah, but I think it's impossible for you or me to go through something that somebody else went through when it was so horrific. Like, I don't know... I'm just referring to myself now. I don't know if I can possibly adequately describe to you what it did to me to see the man in person jump out the window, and then I watched his body. Probably shouldn't have done it, but I did, and it had an impact on me. Probably impossible for anybody else to have that impact except to empathize with me and realize, my goodness, it'd be pretty terrible for me. So I do think people who lived in New York at the time probably have the most impact from it. But it is like one of those things like Pearl Harbor, where everybody knows where they were when it happened. And it's interesting. People feel compelled to tell me that. Probably the most often, not even asked, often repeated conversation I have with strangers about September 11th when they recognize me. And this could be in an Oklahoma airport, San Francisco airport, or it could be in Berlin. They say, oh, that's Rudy Giuliani. They'll come up to me and they'll begin it by telling me where they were that day. Before they ask me what was it like, which they do then go on to do. You know, what was it like? What did it feel like? Rarely I've had the conspiracy people come up, maybe once or twice. Usually it's reasonable. Very often I'll have people come up and thank me for the firefighters that saved them. I get a lot of that. I said, if it wasn't for your firefighters and police officers, I wouldn't have gotten down that building. A couple of them have brought out to me something that isn't made known often. They said, you know, it's amazing you didn't have death by panic. Did you think of all these even things with only 1,000 people trying to get out of a theater and 10 people die of panic? You had thousands and thousands of people get out. Nobody jumped on each other. Nobody jumped over each other. That's a credit to your firefighters and police officers. That's the kind of conversations I get. But it almost always begins with, oh, I was on vacation. I was on vacation in the mountains, and I didn't know about it for a day. It's so terrible. I missed the whole first day. One of my best friends works at Cantor Fitzgerald, and I was so worried, and And then I'll say, well, what happened to your friend? And sometimes they'll say, well, they made it out. Or sometimes they'll say, well, they died. And I say, I'm terribly sorry. But there's almost a compulsion to identify where you were on that day. And I remember in my parents' generation how often they told me over and over again where they were on the day and the moment they found out about where my father was, where my mother was. Their friends would tell you where they were on Pearl Harbor. And then I think that happened with the Kennedy assassination, too. So, yeah, there's no question that it's one of the significant events that has shaped us in ways that I'm not sure. I don't think we know yet exactly how it shaped us. I really do believe. I mean, a lot of people look back on the Kennedy assassination and they think a lot of the disruption, a lot of the social disruption that took place in the 60s and the 70s, some of it was caused by that. I do think that some of what we're going through is caused by September 11th.
Still.
You know, some of the very strange, different ways our patterns have changed, and I think it's going to fix itself, but it's a traumatic experience.
Returning to 1993, can you connect that to September the 11th, how much that should have been a wake-up call? Because it really is a function of the incompetence of the terrorists that we didn't have a worse attack. If that bomb had been larger and had been closer to the right structural member, one tower would have come down immediately onto the second tower. It wouldn't have been 3,000, it would have been 40,000. So 93 is seminal, is it not, in our understanding of 2001?
Oh, no question about it. I mean, what we don't know enough about yet, and we will, as we gather more and more documents are released, we can even see how much connection there was between the two, meaning in terms of planning, because we don't really have a lot of solid information about that. 1993, maybe it didn't help as much as it should have in preparing for 2001, but it helped. Had there not been 1993, 2001 would have been much worse.
Because of the systems that were put in place?
Yes, because of the, both on the city level, the state level, and even on the coordination with the national level. For New York, so let me tell you the good part first. I mean, the good part is that we all realized in New York, and I did it, so I guess I get the credit for it, but this was not something I had to fight for. I mean, this was pretty much a unanimous decision that I had complete support for. Immediately, we developed an emergency management center, which we never had before. I mean, we had something called a management center, but it had nothing to do with things like anthrax, chemical attacks, biological attacks. The first time we did our anthrax drill, which was about a year after that, when the federal government raided us, we had ended up having killed about a third of our fire department because we didn't have the right equipment on. We didn't tell what we were doing. When we finally did handle anthrax, and there I'll tell you, we handled it brilliantly. I mean, the New York City Health Department, the New York City Fire Department, the New York City Police Department handled anthrax and got the casualties down to almost nothing and really kind of helped the rest of the country handle it. We figured out, we immediately had the antibiotic for it. We had three million of them on alert. We could put our hands on 3 million right away, and then another 3 million. Jerry Hauer had gotten them for us. I knew all about anthrax. I knew all about the illness. I knew all about how to handle it. We were ready for four or five other biological chemical attacks, including smallpox, which would have been a horrendous experience for us. We would have to have put people Governor's Island. Governor's Island, and then probably we'd have to have used some of the area around the Icon Stadium. But we had like five places where we would put people, and then for each one of the chemical or biological attacks, we had a protocol. The Friday night after September 11, at 9 o'clock, I held a meeting at Gracie Mansion, secret meeting. in which the federal government fully participated. And we stayed until 3 a.m. and we went over every possible biological or chemical attack that could take place to New York City. And what we would do, what George Pataki would do, the state, and what the federal government would do. So when anthrax happened, 3 weeks later, we were completely ready for it. The other thing I should emphasize that I didn't was the coordination, which was superb.
Across the different levels of government?
It was superb. And when I see the ones that didn't work, when I watch the governor of New York and the mayor of New York fighting over COVID, I said, I don't understand how this is going to work. The moment I had that conversation with George Pataki on the phone, and he thought I was dead and I was alive, and he said, thank God, we really need you. He said, you know, I've pre-positioned the National Guard, but I haven't deployed them because I know how reluctant you are about the National Guard. I said, George, I just changed my mind. I need all the help I can get. This is a different situation. I always was worried about their having to deal with riots, because dealing with riots, as we know, is so sensitive. And our police, despite all of the ridiculous, horrible things that are said, are brilliant at doing it and restrained at doing it. You put an ordinary human being in that situation, and they're going to react like an ordinary human being, and we're going to have terrible, terrible problem. But for something like this, I needed the National Guard. But George and I decided that we become one. We immediately decided we'd take our two staffs. We would meet together every day. We would sit in the same office, like we have partners' desk. And we'd make every decision together. And we made that decision because both of us had been in government long enough to know that we could get along. And if I made a mistake, he'd understand it. And if he made a mistake, I'd understand it. But our staffs would go at each other immediately. And if there was a mistake, it could be attributed to either of us. That would happen. And then if we could blame it on Bush, we would. So we immediately got together. That helped the president very quickly decide the next morning that FEMA would not be anything else other than a help to us. And he told the guy from FEMA that he worked for us. And it stayed that way for the entire time. That coordination was the reason why anthrax was handled so well in New York, and then it helped the rest of the country handle it because we had that working relationship. And now when I see an emergency, like when I saw Katrina and I saw the governor staying at the Capitol, the mayor on some kind of boat, and they didn't like each other or talk to each other, and the guy in FEMA floating around somewhere and nobody knew where he was, Bernie and I both said, this is a disaster waiting to happen. If I can give any wisdom to anyone about an emergency, we're a complicated group of governments. And the federal government cannot handle a terrorist attack because it happens at a local level. There are very, very few federal resources. It has to have a well-trained local response, but they have to be partners. There can be none of this, I'm more important than you are, or I'm the federal government, I tell you what to do. And it's got to be a complete working relationship. And the admiration that I have for George Pataki, because he was the governor and he could have said, Mayor, I'm handling this. But George Pataki knew that it was in the city of New York, not in the city of Albany. And there was one person that knew the city of New York better than anybody else, and that was me. And who was he going to substitute for? So take advantage of me. And the president understood that nobody understood the state of New York and the city of New York better than Pataki and Giuliani. He said, why am I going to boss them around? I don't know. Could it be because we were all Republicans? I'm not sure. George and I supported Mario Cuomo for governor. George and I took 2 years to become friends. We did actually, though, become friends over other things, over personal things. So that might have helped. It is two men I had complete confidence in. And I think they had complete confidence in me. I don't know if it's different when you take Cuomo and de Blasio. The two guys that hate each other. I don't know what happens then, but I think you have to overcome it.
Well, it's not part of the interview, but I want to thank you for what you did for New York then and what you're still doing for America, Mr. Mayor.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Sebastian.
Thank you.
If you need to know any more about this,
thank you.
You're going to take
one last question.
Yeah, what?
Could you talk real quickly, the good one to end on is, with so many people lost, including first responders, why is it important to know the truth about what happened?
Right, so with so many people lost, the greatest terror attack in modern history, why is it so important to know the true story of what happened on that day?
I think the reason to know the true story is you're never going to be able to adequately do a good job of preventing another attack without knowing the true story. When you're planning and making decisions about how to prepare for things and you have incorrect facts, you make incorrect decisions. And you need, first of all, you're never going to know totally accurately what happened. The past is not susceptible to that kind of knowledge because it isn't like a movie. But the closer you can get to what really happened and what really went wrong, the closer you're going to get to being able to prevent it in the future. And I think we have to also get away from this terrible condemnation of people if things go wrong. It's impossible in an emergency for things not to go wrong. Impossible. I don't care if the greatest genius in the world is running it. It's the nature of an emergency that things go wrong. It's minimizing the number of things that go wrong that makes running an emergency really, really excellent.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, deliver the truth, whatever the cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, deliver the truth, whatever the cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.